Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
So 100 years ago, in the aftermath of Ireland's Civil War, the fledgling state turned its attention to building a viable democratic nation. Of course, there were numerous challenges to overcome, but also opportunities to foster a new Ireland and, within that, a cultural ethos. Well, the experiences of 1924 reflected this mix. And joining me today to look at some of that this year's interesting centenaries is Professor of Modern Irish History at UCD, Dermot Farrelly. You're very welcome, Dermot.
Morning, Claire.
Good to see you.
Nice to see
in
you.
This new year. So let's talk about the main challenges then facing the government in 1924. Let's imagine we're back there. It's January 1924.
They were fairly exhausted. There's a mixture of exhaustion and determination and focus. I think it's fair to say Kevin O'Higgins, who was the Minister for Home Affairs in that government in the 1920s, the Cumann na Gael government, did remark that the Civil War had taken years out of them. And they were young governors, most of them. But obviously they had been through that particular period of turbulence, and themselves and their opponents had not reconciled their differences. But the Civil War was over, and they really switched their focus to making the transition from that period of revolution and upheaval to governance. Mm-hmm. And it's about putting the nuts and bolts in place. And a lot of it is about a focus on legislation. And they are remarkably active. There are 62 measures passed in 1924 alone, which, when you compare that to the overall legislative record, is very, very impressive. And you're talking, of course, about getting the state building measures in place that are necessary to mark the distinctiveness of the new state, but also, of course, to clear up any confusion that might exist about the transition from imperial control to domestic control. There was a Courts of Justice Act, for example, in 1924, which is really about establishing the legal mechanisms for the new state, the new courts, the new district court. You have the new High Court, new Supreme Court. So things like that are hugely important. Regulation of the civil service. How does the civil service make the transition from British rule to Irish rule? So you have a lot of attention devoted to that. A lot of it is of a very technical nature. But the interesting thing is that the context, the social context, is very interesting as well in relation to what they were trying to do with what were regarded as severe problems.
But they were, I mean, you started by saying that they were exhausted, you know, they'd come through a really difficult time and they had all this work to do. They'd no choice really but to do it.
Well, one of the difficulties in 1924 is what to do with Republicans who have not reconciled themselves to the new state and aren't going to accept its legitimacy. So even though the guns have gone largely silent, not completely silent, because violence doesn't disappear, it really dribbles away, but there are still many of them interned. There's still unresolved issues around the border and what's going to happen to the future of the island. And of course, there's always the blame game and the deep personal animosities that mm-hmm. existed arising from the Civil War. And of course, their line was, we had to do these things in order to secure the survival of the state. And the previous year, W.T. Cosgrave, as head of government, had said, if I had to execute 10,000 Republicans to ensure the survival of this state, I will. So they take that very firm and hard line. But there are also a lot of internal tensions within that government in relation to their ideological views. Because there are interesting debates in the 1920s about laissez-faire economics and about the extent of state intervention. But the crucial question is, what can they afford to do? An awful lot of the promises and the aspirations that had been outlined, you know, in the lead up to the creation of the Free State, could they possibly be realised given the financial straitened circumstances mm. that exist?
So who are we? What do we want to be? All yeah. of these ideological
and
conversations,
can we afford to
and
be,
then cut your cloth.
Yeah, can we afford to be what we want to be? Take a minister for finance in the 1920s, looking at the balance sheet, looking at the question of establishing a viable domestic economy, not wanting to be starved at the outset of the ability to control economic destiny. So they take a very hard line in relation to the balance sheet on public expenditure, for example.
Mm-hmm. Talk to me about the army crisis then during that
year. Well,
that
was the other unresolved issue. I mean, let's take ourselves back to 1924. There was just shy of 60,000 in the army of the new Free State. Now, that had been necessary due to the Civil War, but it was estimated that they needed to demobilise about 37,000 of the 60,000, and that's between officers and those in the lower ranks. Now, where do they go?
Yeah.
There aren't jobs available for them, and they were really thrown to the wolves. But at the same time, it was not feasible to have an army of that size for a small state at peace or post-civil war. So they have to go about that business. And this generates tensions. That's one aspect of it. Another is the tension that existed around who was given preference within the army. Leadership, discipline and control. Because you have a mixture of pre-treaty IRA, the kind of old IRA. You have those who joined at the time of the Civil War. And then you have ex-British Army men in the new army as well. And there's a lot of resentment about the idea that preferential treatment is being given to those who have joined after the War of Independence is over, just for the Civil War, and to the British Army people. Mm-hmm. And what we get in 1924 is a remarkably audacious statement from two particular senior ranking army officers. This is Charles Dalton and Liam Tobin, who basically see themselves as keepers of the flame of Michael Collins. And they represent a grouping within the army, which is the IRA organization within the army. So they're faithful to the idea of the pre-Civil War vision of Michael Collins, and they don't think enough is being done to deliver on that vision. And they refer in their statement to treachery, that there has been a refusal to follow through on the aspirations. And that is a huge challenge to the government, because one of the big themes of 1924 is whether civilians or the military will control this state. And the way Kevin O'Higgins put it as Minister for Home Affairs, we are not going to take our stride from a soldier's boot. And the idea is that we are now going to take an opportunity to assert civilian and political control over the army. But where does that leave the Minister for Defence, Richard Mulcahy? O'Higgins was keen to sideline Richard Mulcahy because he didn't feel that he had a grasp on the discipline issues within the army. Why had the army officers been allowed to get to the stage where they could issue a defiant statement like that?
Mm-hmm.
So it really is a threatened mutiny rather than a full-blown mutiny.
So what happened?
What happened was that the government insists that the Army Council, which includes Richard Mulcahy, has to resign. Richard Mulcahy, of course, also issued a statement denouncing this threatened mutiny. But there were tensions within government that Mulcahy had not done enough to try and enforce his authority and control, had allowed the Irish Republican Brotherhood, which is another complication because it's still in existence, undue influence within the army. And what's eventually settled on is an army inquiry. So they have an inquiry into these affairs. James Meredith was the judge who presided over that. But Mulcahy is forced to resign because the Executive Council of the Free State of the government insists that the Army Council has to resign. And that includes Richard Mulcahy. Now, historians differ in their interpretations of
Mulcahy's.
Yeah, some see Mulcahy as having been very dignified in resigning and that he ensured that he would take the heat out of this situation. Others would see Kevin O'Higgins as having been the most assertive character at that time. Interestingly, both of them claimed the same thing, that what they ultimately wanted, of course, was political control over the army. So it's a combination of all of those different factors, but you'll appreciate the destabilisation it caused. But it was also an opportunity for O'Higgins and others in cabinet to assert themselves.
So what happened then to all of those tens of thousands of people that the army no longer needed in their employ?
Well, a few years ago, I started going through the files of those who were contesting their demobilisation orders, because they were told that they were surplus to requirements, and there was an association formed for ex-National Army men. And by the middle of the 1920s, quite a number of them are sleeping rough in the Phoenix Park. You take a typical recruit during the Civil War who had given up, say, their work on the family farm,
yes,
who had also forfeited their right to maybe inherit that farm. They don't have the option of going back. So they're unemployed. Some of them emigrate. Some of them are forced, obviously, to if they can get jobs, to take them at a much lower rate of pay than they may have been used
mm-hmm.
to. And many of them become destitute.
Now, let's talk about, because I mentioned, forming this cultural framework in the new state, and alcohol was a big feature, and it was something that it was felt there should be a focus on in terms of new legislation. So talk us through that.
Well, it was by no means a sideshow. I mean, there was a Department of Justice memorandum in 1924 that stated this alcohol issue was the most important social issue facing the country. So we shouldn't underestimate it.
And now, was it? Like, is there evidence to show that it was?
Oh, there was all sorts of evidence. I mean, convictions for drunkenness had dropped quite significantly from 10 years previously in 1914. There were about 7,500 convictions for drunkenness in the Free State in 1924. But there are a number of different issues. The way Kevin O'Higgins put it, because again, his department has responsibility for licensing legislation, we're facing a bewildering maze of statutes and decisions, he says, because you're talking about inheriting this very complicated legal and licensing code from previous administrations. And they go back years and years and they're trying to rationalise it. They want to reduce the opening hours of pubs. They want to stamp out illicit distillation. They want compulsory endorsement of licences if those who hold them are not sticking to the rules. Mm-hmm. There are also some questions about the bona fide rule, about whether people could, how people could drink when they were travelling and so on. There were an awful lot of different abuses, but you also have a licensed Vintners Association, which has been in existence since the early 19th century. And the way a Department of Justice memorandum puts it, they are vested and not to be disturbed. So they're very powerful, and some of them have very close connections to the common and loyal government. But at the same time, there is a determination to bring in reforms. And some of the memoranda are quite amusing in retrospect, because they were talking about a uniform closing hour of 10 o'clock at night. And the point was made that if you apply that to performance venues, what would happen at 9:45 when the performance wasn't over? The Department of Justice memorandum said there would be a stampede for the bar at 9:45 p.m. There would be people swilling drinks in the corridors and the lavatories, and they'd be disturbing the performances. So you've all of these kind of issues.
And they were right.
Of course they were right. Well, some things never change. Yeah. But they did. They did tighten up things. But what is really interesting is that there were 16,000 licensed premises in the Free State in 1925. There was one for every 263 people in Ireland, compared to in Scotland, one for every 695 people.
You should see the legacy in towns all over the place, you know, the closed pub or what used to be the pub. Yeah. You know, you can
and George Russell, the writer, AE, he complained bitterly during this period that there were so many towns, small towns and villages in Ireland that had an abundance of pubs, but they didn't have a gymnasium, or they didn't have a library, or they didn't have other forms of recreation. And this is also the era of temperance advocates. Mm-hmm. And there's a debate developing internationally about prohibition and the appropriateness of that. So a lot of those other currents feed into this debate about licensing legislation.
So going back to what we would like to do and what we can afford to do, there was a cut to the old age pension, wasn't there?
This was a huge controversy in 1924. Ernest Blythe was the Minister for Finance. He was icy. And again, he was looking at his balance sheet. The amount that was available for public expenditure was about £20 million. Of that £20 million, £3.2 million was going on the old age pension. And there was codology and skullduggery of the highest form when it came to the old age pension in Ireland. Because this had been introduced by a British Liberal government way back, 1908, 1909. And suddenly it was discovered that there were an awful lot more people than they estimated, over 70 in Ireland, who were entitled to the 5 shilling pension.
Who were they? Dead people?
What they were people who were lying and engaging in welfare fraud on a grand scale, because registration of births did not become legal in Ireland until 1864. So it was very difficult to prove if people were over 70 or not. And the British government was discovering that they totally underestimated how many pensions they would have to pay in Ireland. Now, the way Seamus Burke, the Minister for Local Government, put it in 1924, that was okay and was fair game when we were raiding the Imperial Exchequer. But the problem now,
it's our money.
It's our money. And we can't tolerate this anymore. And they began to look at the nature of fraud. By this stage, it's 10 shillings. And the argument made by Blythe is that the cost of living had reduced, that rate had been set at a time when the cost of living was more expensive in Britain and that it shouldn't continue to apply for Ireland. So we lopped a shilling off the old age pension, and there was a furore over it. And you'll appreciate that. Now, he spared those who were over 80, but they also said they would clamp down on the means test and they would begin to supervise this in a much more exact way. And it did huge damage to the Common and Royal Government. Even though it was restored in 1928, the political damage had been done. And the pension was hugely important in relation to the dignity of older people. Yeah. And it was not an insignificant sum. And they had got used to it. It saved them from the workhouse, yeah, many
and
of them.
And it still is very important. And we see that, you know, controversies still arise when anyone tries to go near it. Was there an issue with trust in this new government and new state?
Oh, there always is. I mean, clearly, Cumann na Gael is operating in a parliament that doesn't have the main opposition. You know, the Labour Party are there, of course, a smaller Labour Party, but the anti-treaty Republicans still have not taken their seats.
Yeah.
So there is that question of how representative they are and how accountable they are. Mm-hmm. But of course, they were making the case that they had to get on with the business of governance, and they had to be mindful of the balance sheet. And they had to weigh up the different responsibilities that they had. But of course, there were those who insisted that this was an example of a government that was uncaring. And Patrick McGilligan, another minister in that government, was on record as saying that people may have to die in this country and die of starvation. And he said that in 1924. So there are interesting tensions about the lack of state intervention or the determination to allow the market to dictate. And at the same time, there are reductions in income tax for those who are high earners. So obviously those on the left of the political spectrum were highlighting that and insisting that the government was betraying the welfare of people. But this is well before the full development of the welfare state, mm-hmm. which is why the old age pension was so important.
You see, you've come through the War of Independence, you've come through the Civil War. Now we have what the aim always was, but our pensions are being cut. Our army personnel, many of them are losing their jobs, unemployment rates are high and life is really difficult.
And prices for agricultural produce have declined so dramatically compared to, say, the period of the First World War. There's huge demand for Irish agricultural produce. So you have that very important sector in Ireland, which is feeling the strain in the 1920s as well. And of course, you're also heading towards a very volatile international economic climate mm-hmm. as the 1920s progresses.
So what about finding its feet culturally? How did Ireland perform on that side of things?
Well, it was interesting that Owen McNeill was the Minister for Education in that government. And again, he's very hostile to the idea of a very aggressive state intervention when it comes to cultural ethos and language policy issues, for example. And he said in 1924 that you might as well put wooden legs on hens as try to restore Irish through the schools system.
Right.
And, you know, he didn't believe it was the job of the state to manufacture a cultural revolution when it came to the most important cultural ambition of that generation, which was to generate an Irish speaking island. And at the same time, as Minister for Education, he had to do something about it. Mm-hmm. And the way the Department of Education put it in 1924 was that the main problem facing the promotion of the Irish language is that speaking Irish is inextricably linked with social inferiority and poverty. And they have a particular interest in the historic congested districts, you know, the repositories of an ancient Irish culture. So they do have to do something about the school system to get infants being taught entirely through Irish for the first 2 years of their schooling. But of the 12,000 lay teachers that were employed in national schools, only about a third of them were qualified to the degree required when it came to Irish language proficiency. So they put a lot of resources into training those teachers. Some of that is quite successful. They also introduce an incentivized grants scheme, A, B and C, depending on how much Irish is being used in individual schools. And the way the Department of Education put it, we have to show that Irish pays. Mm-hmm. So that becomes official policy.
Mm-hmm. And so leads to where we got. We could keep going, you know, we'll keep going about this 1 year, 1924, but our time is up. Dermot, thanks very much. You'll be back with us in a few weeks, though, to look at another time in our history. That's Dermot Ferriter, back after this.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.